While I was coming out of the Pentagon, I didn't see any evidence of metal, airplane seats, luggage, nothing that would give me any indication that it was a plane that had hit the building. I lost one shoe, so I was walking through the area barefooted. So I was particularly careful to try to make sure I did not step on anything sharp while I had my son on my shoulder. I did not have jet fuel over my body. My son didn't have jet fuel over his body. The people that I helped didn't have jet fuel on their body. So again, there was nothing on the inside that would give me any indication that there was a plane on that particular day that hit the building. Most of the people that were in the area where I was located, and again, I did ask because maybe I was off in my judgment, but in speaking with everyone, it was conclusive that no one else in the area where I was located had seen any parts of planes or luggage or baggage or anything of that nature. Yes, I believe it's something part of much more sinister, and that's why my goal is to try to push for a federal grand jury so that people can be brought forth for perjury and obstruction of justice. I mean, when you go out of your way to fabricate an official story, when obviously the evidence that appears, whether it's footage or the work that many people have done, shows that the official story couldn't possibly be true, then yes, you should be brought to justice. And when people can come together and feel like they can utilize, human beings as lambs to a slaughter, yes, that's what's unpatriotic, that's what's un-American. We'll turn our own people to sacrifice them for whatever their motive may be, regardless that their motive is of no significance, but the fact that they would use innocent human beings as lambs to a slaughter to perpetrate whatever it is their cause or motive is. Yes, they should be brought to justice, and it's obvious, that the official story has been fabricated.
And here is an aerial photo showing a large E-ring cavity inside the outer E-ring wall of Wedge 2, not just Wedge 1, where the official story says a plane impacted and there was later a collapse. April Gallup, also, you should know, for 9/11 truth aficionados, did not walk out of the alleged entrance hole. Of course, there wasn't an entrance hole to begin with to walk out of. But the first official interview that she gave, which was to the Army historians, she stated that she and her son exited through a window behind the Fort Myer fire truck that you have already seen, the back of which was on fire after the white plane exploded there at 9:32:30 and stopped the heliport clock at that time. And the Army historians also interviewed the other people that helped her and her infant son out of that blown out window just behind the fire truck. And here you see the fire truck, and you can see the blown out window behind the back of the fire truck. And then just as the outer columns, as we've seen to the right and left of the alleged impact point of Flight 77 in Wedge 1 were bowed outwards, not inwards, in other words, consistent with an internal explosion with its pressure wave coming out instead of an external impact by a large, heavy, fast-flying object. Similarly, in Wedge 2, further north, where April Gallup worked, a massive internal force thrust office debris towards the outer windows. And you can see them. If this were a higher resolution photo, you could clearly see that this office debris is just forced out of the windows. Windows also first bowed out and then back in. Witness Lieutenant Colonel Victor Correa, who worked in the office of the Army Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, in the direct path of the alleged official story penetration of Flight 77, said, quote, "I noticed the windows going out and then coming back in. We thought it was some kind of an explosion, that somebody had got in there and planted bombs because of that." Army Fort Monmouth TDY auditor Michael Nielsen, whom I personally interviewed, told me, quote, "Hundreds of people raced down the halls past him out the south side exit, shouting, 'It's a bomb, bombs, it's a bomb,' i.e. explosives. And as a plane did not hit at the Wedge 1 impact point, this famous 5 frames video, which we're showing again, is therefore evidence of what? Only of an explosion and or the white plane destruction. Not of an impact. There were also multiple primary inside explosions independent of any impact or fires therefrom. We've already seen April Gallup says that her watch was stopped by this massive explosion by her desk in Wedge 2 at 9:30, at 9:31.
And 40 seconds.
Stopped Navy area clock, which we saw very early with this firehouse clock. And at precisely 9:43, the, according to the official story, sole survivor of the Naval Command Center, which was the second and third rings in the alleged penetration path of Flight 77, stated at precisely 9:43 was the explosion in the Naval Command Center. At 10 o'clock, explosives went off on columns in the alleged penetration path. And at 9:48, there was another large Pentagon explosion. There were bombs going off inside the buildings over quite a long period of time. This slide shows the relative times of the inside the building explosions at the Pentagon on 9/11 relative to the outside explosions at the Pentagon that morning. At 9:30, as we have seen in Wedge 2, well to the north of where the official story says Flight 77 allegedly impacted, almost 8 minutes later, April Gallup's wristwatch was stopped by a massive explosion inside the building at 9:30. At 9:31 and 40 seconds, another inside the building explosion stopped the Navy area clock. Now, this was also the likely time of the D-ring explosion that thrust the second floor slab upwards. And then there is an external explosion, the one we know about at 9:32 and 30 seconds, when the white plane was destroyed near the heliport, stopping the heliport firehouse clock at that time. But there was also another external explosion, and that was at approximately 9:34 and 10 seconds. That was when the huge billowing black smoke cloud started to billow upwards from a diesel trailer fire outside the Wedge 1 wall near the official story alleged impact point. And we know that time because it was caught on the DoubleTree Hotel security camera digital clock. The next inside the building explosion, and this was at, quote, precisely 9:43. According to Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer, who according to the official story was the only survivor of the Naval Command Center that morning, he said that a massive orange fireball explosion went off in the Naval Command Center at precisely 9:43. And at 9:48, according to the Secret Service's log that morning, there was yet another Pentagon explosion. And the well-known explosion at the Pentagon at approximately 10 a.m., explosives likely went off on inside columns in the alleged penetration path of Flight 77, causing the Wedge 1 E-ring collapse over the alleged impact point at about 10 o'clock. The Pentagon also was expecting explosives. According to AP report on 9/11 itself, the Pentagon attack came minutes after Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld predicted there will be another event. There were bomb-sniffing dog teams at the Pentagon before the attack. Inside explosives at the Pentagon, just as at the World Trade Center, explain why there was no advanced siren to alert personnel of alleged approaching danger to evacuate the building, as there was no incoming at the time of the alleged official story Pentagon attack. The National Military Command Center didn't learn of any alleged incoming hijacked plane until 9:31, after the explosion. There was no way for non-perpetrators of the actual inside job to know the explosives were about to go off in order to trigger alarms and an evacuation. And April Gallup and many others testified there was no alert to trigger them to leave the building to save their lives. Even after Pentagon workers shouted a bomb had gone off, still no alarm sounded, according to Don Perkle. And the chief NBC Pentagon correspondent on 9/11, Jim Miklaszewski, I believe, stated at 9:45, still no sirens and no official evacuation order. Primary inside explosions at the Pentagon are absolute proof of what? An inside job. Outside terrorists, whether Al-Qaeda or Santa Claus, could not have done it. Non-insider terrorists would have targeted the easy-to-hit roof or the central courtyard. or the offices of high-ranking officials on the far side from the official impact point, where Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had their offices. They would never have chosen the least populated, newly hardened, only newly hardened West Wedge, which was also the hardest to hit due to many physical obstacles in the path, a hill, an antenna, light poles, a chain link fence, and the 6 foot high spools. Now you're going to see evidence that some of these, at least some, if not all, of the inside explosives were targeted to take out particular functions and perhaps even individuals. The Naval Command Center was targeted not by a plane, but by inside explosives. This is a graphic from the Washington Post immediately after the attacks that was actually titled The Targeted Ones. And it's a little bit difficult to see, but where they show that the plane, alleged that the plane hit at the official story point, then there is that kind of gray, darker gray area, and within that is the Naval Command Center, which is blown up in the legend up at the top. And in the right-hand corner is number 8, which is the Naval Intelligence Cell. And that turns out to be very important. The Naval Command Center official story is that only one person survived the Naval Command Center on 9/11. That's important because that part was between 2 and 3 rings in from the official story alleged impact point of the plane. It says that only Kevin Schaefer was the survivor at the Naval Command Center. He became a top staffer, I think not coincidentally, on the key 9/11 commission subgroup that was allegedly investigating the Pentagon attack and DOD's NORAD's non-response, which was the heart of the 9/11 PSYOP, including 3 NORAD versions, at least, as Professor Griffin has pointed out, at least 2 of which must be false, if not all 3. Just briefly, the Naval Command Center cover-up is important because I interviewed Rear Admiral Hathaway, who was in charge of the Naval Command Center on 9/11, and he told me that the official story is not true, that Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer was not the only survivor, that in that little intel cell, he stated that there in the intelligence cell, which was a hardened room, hardened against bombs itself on the inside of the Pentagon, there were 18 to 19 intelligence officers, most of whom also survived. Why is that not part of the official story? Follow the money. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and the Pentagon's comptroller,
Dov Zakheim,
publicly acknowledged the day before 9/11 on September 10th that the Pentagon was missing and could not account for $2.3 trillion.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracies. According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion.
Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon, to which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them? Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the 4 war games on September 11th. I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today, and then I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
Thank you, Representative. The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Susan Lindauer has stated publicly at the Vancouver hearings, at which I was also a speaker and an expert witness, that the CIA knew this was actually $5 trillion at that time. The Army Financial Audit Area and the records therein were destroyed in the attack in the area close to April Gallup's desk with those inside explosives that she insists went off right around 9:30. And she also, if you recall, claimed that the only fires she saw on the inside of the E-ring and Wedge 2 were coming out of the Army area computers. Flight 77 not only did not hit the Pentagon, it didn't get anywhere close, and it was never ID'd, ever, affirmatively ID'd, as the eastward flying plane that approached the Pentagon at almost 9:38. With Barbara Olson's phone calls now officially non-existent per the FBI, American Airlines, and the Pentagon, there is, according to Professor David Ray Griffin, and I agree with him, zero, that is no evidence that the outgoing plane, whatever it was, even turned back east. And with its transponder off, Dulles Air Traffic Control had only a blip, never a positive ID, and did not have any altitude or speed, which has been confirmed in a videotaped interview by Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta, that when he talked to the FAA, to Monty Belger, that Belger said they did not have altitude or speed. And there was a C-130 pilot that allegedly saw the attack on the Pentagon. That is not true. He never ID'd the plane, and he did not see the impact.
Which can be proven from the now-released audio tapes from the air traffic control tower that the C-130 pilot was talking to, and from the radar records. Regarding the plane that took off from Dulles at 8:20, the reason I said, quote, whatever it was, unquote, is because the Official Bureau of Transportation, or BTS, online database statistics for all live civilian flights that flew on 9/11 that morning does not include Flight 77.
The FDR, the Flight Data Recorder data fields, also, this alleged flight data recorder from Flight 77 that one group of officials at the Pentagon said was found just inside the entrance hole, and another group of Pentagon officials said was found just inside the exit hole. The flight data recorder data fields that could have positively identified the FDR as coming from Flight 77 or even from any American Airlines plane at all had been zeroed out. And according to FDR expert Dennis Cimino, had been intentionally removed. This is further proof that the flight data recorder data, importantly based upon which the Pentagon has claimed that it learned the time of the attack of almost 9:38 from the FDR. Further proof it was doctored is that the data from that FDR was downloaded 4 hours before the Pentagon reportedly found it. Why the 9:37 and 46 seconds so-called, I call it the FDR or radar data plane, cannot be Flight 77? At 8:54 and 43 seconds, Indianapolis FAA Air Traffic Control, which was tracking what they believed was Flight 77, began a descent before the official story says it turned back east. And it had already descended, according to the Christian Science Monitor, some 6,000 feet by the time its transponder was turned off. However, according to the official story, to the Pentagon itself, the flight data recorder plane, alleged to be Flight 77, didn't begin its descent until after the turn back east of whatever plane it was, and didn't begin its descent until 9:01. And as the same physical plane cannot do both, the official story FDR plane cannot be Flight 77. Thus, the flight data recorder allegedly found in the Pentagon rubble, whether it was found, wherever it was found, claimed to have been from this 9:38 plane also cannot have been from Flight 77. So if the FDR plane that approached the Pentagon at almost 9:38 wasn't Flight 77, what was it? Evidence it was a military plane. All of the Dulles air traffic controllers thought it was a military plane. Daniel O'Brien, who was the Dulles air traffic controller tracking that blip, said the speed, the maneuverability, the way he turned, and again, there was no altitude and no speed information attached to this. We all thought in the radar room, they were then many people standing around her back looking at the screen. We all thought in the radar room, all of us experienced air traffic controllers, that it was a military plane.
In the room, it was almost a sense of relief. This must be a fighter. This must be one of our guys.
So, what happened to Flight 77? The bottom line is we don't know. The government needs to tell us. This is what we do know. We know that at 9:09 and 55 seconds, FAA, Indianapolis Air Traffic Control, reported that flight missing, the flight that had left Dulles Airport at 8:20 in the morning, reported it missing and possibly crashed to the Air Force Search and Rescue. It is not a coincidence, in my opinion, that it was at this exact second, almost, that military air traffic controllers first, in quotes, reported picking up the never positively identified eastward flying blip, that they then violated all established protocol to assume and claim was Flight 77 when it was not, clearly intended, in my opinion, to stop the Air Force from search and rescue. The non-coincidence of this timing, I believe, is strong evidence that the military had been tracking the eastward flying plane all along via military transponder mode that only it and not the FAA civilian air traffic controllers could see. And thus, for the military, there was no so-called radar hole, making the plane invisible for this part of its flight. And also that the official story plane, alleged to have been Flight 77, was a military plane giving off a friendly identify friend or foe IFF transponder signal would explain why it did not trigger any interceptor response and was not shot down. Therefore, in my opinion, I do not believe that there was any stand-down order needed to explain what happened at the Pentagon for two important reasons. One, it wasn't a civilian airliner. We've shown that by many means. And it didn't get through the system, the defense system, to hit the building in any case. In summary, Flight 77 was nowhere near the Pentagon when inside explosives went off over 5 minutes before it allegedly even approached the building, was nowhere near the Pentagon when a white plane with two stripes, red and blue, or red, orange, and blue, made to simulate an American airline plane, exploded near or at the heliport, stopping the heliport clock at 9:32 and 30 seconds, over 5 minutes before the official story says Flight 77 got anywhere near the Pentagon. Also, there is zero evidence that whatever plane left Dulles at 8:20 turned back east at all towards Washington, D.C. in any case. And the westward flying blip was reported possibly crashed by FAA to Air Force search and rescue before it even turned east. And even if whatever plane was flying east had hit the Pentagon, which it didn't, we have proven, it couldn't have penetrated to just the inside of the C-ring, as claimed by the official story, and have caused the massive destruction found all the way into the innermost A and B rings. And finally, the FDR plane, alleged to have been Flight 77, was almost certainly a military plane. The real story at the Pentagon, I believe, I have proven to you, is thus the same as the real story at the World Trade Center on 9/11. That story is pre-placed inside the building explosives with plane approaches and impacts and or destructions of the plane as the cover causes. And inside explosives at both the World Trade Center and the Pentagon can mean only one thing. 9/11 was literally an inside job. How do we identify the operational mass murderers? We would need to know who made and controlled the weaponized military-grade nanothermite that has been found, some of it unreacted, in the World Trade Center dust, number one. And I believe we would need to know who made and controlled the weaponized nanospores in the anthrax letters, which were dated September 11th, after all, and who specializes in nanosol gel processes, which use silicon and silica that were found both in the World Trade Center dust and in the anthrax letter spores. And who would that be? So who could have controlled weapons-grade nanothermite of the signature in the World Trade Center dust? Well, I found out. This is at least one serious possibility. It may not be the only one. But remember, this is an inside job. Quote, from Army Major Doug Rocky, retired director of the United States Army's depleted uranium project, to both myself and Professor Stephen Jones in Irvine, California. I was standing only approximately 1.5 feet from him when he said this. The only guys I know who have this stuff are the golden boys at the Army's Redstone Arsenal. So who controlled the super military grade nano anthrax in the anthrax letters? According to the world's foremost independent investigator of the anthrax letter attacks, Barry Kissen, who is an attorney in the Washington, D.C. area? The answer is Battelle Memorial Institute, which is a U.S. government military intelligence lab, and the CIA, and possibly also the Defense Intelligence Agency, the armies, there's the Army again, Dugway Proving Ground. And I learned from my research that William Patrick, who is now deceased, he was one of the U.S. government's top bioweapons experts, used to work at Fort Detrick also, that William Patrick held the private trade secret, one should ask why private, the private trade secret to the process to create the 1 trillion spores per gram anthrax that was found in the letters. Who could handle military-grade explosives and anthrax that were found in the World Trade Center dust and the anthrax letters? Once they have been created, I would think it would take a military special operators, black ops, trained in super weaponized nanoparticles to set nano explosives and deliver nanobiological weapons. This would be a highly trained, highly specialized black joint special operations team, I would think, like in particular the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, and that works hand in glove with the CIA's Special Activities Division, which we learned from New York Times articles operate above the law with exemption to execute covert operations inside the United States on behalf of the president. In that time, of course, the president was George W. Bush. But as we'll see, JSOC was actually overseen by Vice President Cheney. The Joint Forces Command also happens to script, plan, and run the military's exercises and war games. And we have seen that on the morning of 9/11, they were running NORAD, Northeast Sector, which was responsible for not responding, that the NORAD's Northeast Sector was running an hijack scenario exercise on the morning of 9/11 itself. And the FAA hijack coordinator on 9/11, who should have been at his desk, Army Lieutenant General Michael Canavan, guess what he'd done just before that? He'd headed JSOC. When Canavan first took the job, only about 9 months before 9/11, he began running and participating in military exercises that, according to FAA Intelligence Division analyst John Hawley, quote, pretty damn close to the 9/11 plot itself. And on the morning of 9/11, Canavan's whereabouts were, quote, unknown, and the 9/11 Commission didn't consider it important enough to ask where he was. Under whose command is JSOC? According to Cy Hirst, Vice President Cheney oversaw the Joint Special Operations Command before and on 9/11. And Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and forming top Army Green Beret, there's the Army again, Robert Andrews, reportedly, according to alternative press, headed Cheney's blackest dark ops under JSOC. Susan Lindauer has sworn under oath that before 9/11, her CIA handler ordered her to threaten Iraq's UN ambassador that if they didn't turn over intelligence about imminent hijack plots with airplanes, i.e. like the 9/11 plot, that the U.S. would bomb their country, and that this threat came from, quote, higher than the CIA director and the Secretary of State, which could only mean the Secretary of Defense, Vice President Cheney, or President Bush. Stephen Pieznik, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State to three U.S. presidents, has stated publicly that he is willing to name under oath to the proper venue the military general who was on Deputy Secretary of Defense's Wolfowitz staff on 9/11, who told him that the 9/11 attacks were a false flag attack. Quote, they ran the attacks, the general said of Wolfowitz, Cheney's aide Hadley, Elliot Abrams, Condoleezza Rice, among others. How did they do it? I believe the evidence shows that 9/11 was a red, white, and blue smoke and mirrors preemptive self-attack, planned and executed under cover of hijack scenario exercises, onto which the neocon high cabal, headed by Wolfowitz, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, planned and orchestrated the overlay of inside-the-building explosives to ensure its spectacular success, a la the Reichstag fire, while also taking out targeted offices and functions, i.e. the Naval Command Center and the Army auditors who were trying to track the $2.3 trillion that Rumsfeld had acknowledged to Congress, to Cynthia McKinney's question, by the way, the day before 9/11 was allegedly missing. NORAD's Northeast Sector Operational Commander on 9/11, Colonel Bob Marr, just happens to be an expert in red team gaming verisimilitude. Verisimilitude is a fancy word for making an exercise or war game seem real. There's no better way to make it seem real than to make it real, is it? To go live. He was an expert in red team gaming verisimilitude and has publicly acknowledged that his Northeast NORAD sector was conducting hijack scenario emergency response exercises on the morning of 9/11 itself. It's in this book, Touching History. Richard Clark revealed to me in an interview I did with him at the Naval Postgraduate School as the senior military affairs journalist there on August 30th, 2010, and I published this on the DOD's website. He said that the White House clears every major exercise, as I mentioned before, meaning Condoleezza Rice and probably Cheney and Bush, and certainly Cheney, would have known about those hijack scenario exercises being run on the morning of 9/11, which were then used as part of the pretext for why NORAD didn't respond in time. White House approval of hijack scenario exercises being run on 9/11 itself would have to have been known about and approved by at least Rice and Clark. JSOC NORAD exercise scenario planners and executors were the core, I believe, of the operational plot. Why NORAD, which is an Air Force agency, lied at least twice and probably three times to Congress, as well as the 9/11 Commission, putting out three contradictory timelines of its non-responses of its fighter jets in time. And the 9/11 Commission seriously considered referring NORAD DOD to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation for lying and obstruction of justice. 9/11, in my very educated opinion, was not just an evil inside plot, it was a diabolical inside plot, whose purpose was, in my opinion, to terrorize the United States into putting Israel's interest above our own. I call that treason. To get the United States military into the Middle East, as Nicholas Rockefeller told Russo a year before 9/11, this was a longtime goal of the Project for New American Century U.S. and Israeli Zionists, to affect Israel's goals using American blood and treasure, which is still happening. CENTCOM, which stands for Central Command, the Central Combatant Command of the United States military of the Pentagon, had already, before 9/11, been moved to the Middle East. You would think that CENTCOM would be centered over the United States. Well, one of the reasons for that is, as you have already learned, there was no combatant command over the mainland United States until immediately after 9/11, when they created NORTHCOM for that very purpose. Reported dual Israeli-U.S. citizen Paul Wolfowitz was Deputy Secretary of Defense, number two immediately under Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. Richard Pearl, reported dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, proclaimed himself one of the top Project for New American Century Manifesto signatories. He self-proclaimed himself the Prince of Darkness. And he chaired Rumsfeld's Defense Policy Board.
If Richard Pearl is the Prince of Darkness, Dov Zakheim is the king. Dov Zakheim is a rabbi and reported dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. He wrote a paper advocating a staged catastrophic event to force the United States into war, to reconfigure the Middle East in Israel's interest, and presented it to the Project for New American Century before they wrote the Project for New American Century Manifesto. And Zakheim is credited with the actual new Pearl Harbor quote in that manifesto. Zakheim headed all of the Pentagon's accounts as its DOD comptroller under Rumsfeld, as the $2.3 trillion was announced being missing the day before 9/11 on September 10th. CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer says it was really $9.1 trillion and that it had gone for Israel. Pentagon auditors tracking the missing money, killed on 9/11 by inside explosives in the Pentagon, and the records were destroyed. Zakheim was the chief executive officer of Systems Planning Corporation, a defense contractor that specialized in remote control of airplanes, especially drone aircraft, used in U.S. military exercises, and a special system which destroyed them in their terminal phases. This is what the evidence shows actually happened at the Pentagon on 9/11. Systems Planning Corporation had a subsidiary that actually
oversaw the 1993 World Trade Center 1 attack, so-called investigation, and through that investigation obtained the secret World Trade Center blueprints, which were needed to know where to plant controlled demolition explosives throughout the building. Dov Zakheim arranged for the Pentagon to receive leased converted Boeing 767 fuel tanker planes, which are consistent with what eyewitnesses saw of the plane that actually struck World Trade Center 2 on 9/11. Reported dual Israeli-U.S. citizen Philip Zelikow headed the 9/11 Commission cover-up as its executive director. Reported dual U.S. Israeli citizen Michael Chertoff headed the Department of Justice alleged, quote, investigation, which is a cover-up of 9/11, and became the second new Department of Homeland Security director. So we must ask whose homeland and whose security. The insider 9/11 plot was the highest evil because it was premeditated. It was based on a Hitlerian scale big lie. We have seen that not just the whole official story of 9/11 is a lie, but every single individual part of it is a lie. The 9/11 plot was designed to kill masses of our innocent fellow citizens. It was designed to falsely blame and demonize Muslims who could not have done it and did not do it. It was created to justify the invasion of their lands in the Middle East for geopolitical power, oil, and Israel's interest. The alleged aggressive 9/11 wars that have killed hundreds of thousands, displaced millions, and cost our country trillions are based entirely on lies and are the highest crime under international law and the Nuremberg Principles, which we wrote as the victors over the Nazis in World War II. So what is the source of this high evil? Incredibly, it is the mentality of Nazism. So who and what are the neocons really? The 9/11 Pentagon neocons, Wolfowitz, Prince of Darkness himself, Richard Pearl, Shalabi, Khalilzad, were all students and are followers of neocon chief philosopher Leo Strauss. They all studied under Professor Strauss at the University of Chicago. And Professor Strauss' ideology is even more extremist than his personal mentor and sponsor in Germany, Hitler's own legal theorist, Carl Schmitt. The Schmitt-Strauss doctrine is that the state needs enemies and must create them if necessary, and must fabricate lies for the many, for the people, while its leaders, quote, embrace the darkness, unquote.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows.
Leo Strauss taught that, quote, those who are fit to rule are those who realize there is no morality and that there is only one so-called natural right, the right of the superior man to rule over the inferior. This is from Leo Strauss in The American Right, a book published about Strauss's so-called philosophy in 1997. Leo Strauss's neocons literally brainstormed the attacks of 9/11 decades before those attacks. Attorney Stanley Hilton studied under Leo Strauss with Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl at the University of Chicago. Hilton's senior thesis under Strauss detailed a plan to establish a presidential dictatorship in the United States using a fabricated Pearl Harbor-like incident as its justification. Stanley Hilton, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, Leo Strauss, and others discussed an array of different plots and incidents like September 11th and flying airplanes into buildings way back in the 1960s. And note that the book that Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, passed out hundreds of copies of shortly before the 9/11 attacks was the 1962 book by top neocon Roberto Wolfstetter. The 9/11 neocon's mentor's mentor, therefore, was Hitler's own justifier of evil, Nazi Carl Schmitt. This is a quote from Professor Francis Boyle, an internationally renowned professor of international law at the University of Illinois. Quote, Schmidt was the most notorious Nazi law professor of his day, justifying every atrocity the Nazis inflicted on everyone. We're talking about the Holocaust. We must understand that these so-called neoconservatives are, in fact, neo-Nazis. They espouse the Nazi doctrine of Schmidt and Strauss and Machiavelli and Nietzsche, the doctrine of the Superman, unquote. This is what internationally acclaimed journalist Seymour Hersh had to say. Quote, "We, that is the United States, has been taken over basically by a cult. 8 or 9 neoconservatives, we've seen they're really neo-Nazis in their mentality, have somehow grabbed the U.S. government. Just how and why they did it so efficiently, we'll have to wait for much later historians and for better documentation than we have now. But they managed to overcome the federal bureaucracy and the Congress and the press with the greatest of ease. This does say something about how fragile our democracy is." Unquote. Lawrence Wilkerson, who was chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell in the Bush-Cheney administration, about this same coup said, "It's not a coup, it's worse." This is how retired 4-star U.S. Army general and top NATO commander Wesley Clark put it in a 2003 public address at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
What happened in 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country, a coup, a policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. Then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later, I saw the same officer, I said, Why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, "Oh, sir." He says, "It's worse than that." He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, "I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in 7 countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran." I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then, it came back to me, a 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001 he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991 he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number 3 position in the Pentagon. It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments? It's not to sort of deter conflict? We're going to invade countries? And, I you know, my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Now, did anybody ever tell you that? Was there a national dialogue on this? Did senators and congressmen stand up and denounce this plan? Was there a full-fledged American debate on it? Absolutely not. And there still isn't.
The truth is, our government was and still is penetrated and controlled by a Zionist Israeli fifth column that took over the White House, the Congress, the military-civilian superstructure, key military officers and intelligence personnel, and the mainstream media leading up to, on, and after 9/11. The level and extent of this penetration is unprecedented in the history of the world and amounts to a literal invasion by an un-American and hostile force. The same year, 2003, that General Wesley Clark gave that warning that the United States government, civilian superstructure of the military, key military officers and special operators and intelligence personnel had been taken over by an Israeli neocon fifth column coup, Israel's own Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, frustrated that his Middle East destabilization and domination plan wasn't going as well and as quickly as planned, declared that the United States had already conquered Iraq. Remember Bush's famous false and absurd premature mission accomplished speech from the deck of a Navy ship that same year, 2003? Ariel Sharon went on that it was time that the U.S. marched against Libya, Syria, and Iran. Note that President Obama has made Sharon's Libya demand already a reality, that the U.S. is now destabilizing Syria by supporting none other than Al-Qaeda-affiliated Syrian so-called rebels, and that the war drums are building now for an attack on Iran. I do not believe it is a coincidence that the same lead actor who played in the movie Pearl Harbor, Ben Affleck, that prepared the ground for the American public to accept the, quote, new Pearl Harbor, unquote, meme for the inside job 9/11 attacks, just happens to be the producer, director, and leading actor of the new movie Argo, a transparent piece of Hollywood CIA propaganda which is intended to demonize Iran and prepare the American public to now accept a war against that final nation in the neocons' quickly falling row of Middle East dominoes. Facts alone are not enough. Our 9/11 truth movement, I believe, needs to become the heart and soul, maybe the main impetus of a global truth force movement. And Mahatma Gandhi actually initiated precisely such a movement in India, which he called Truth Force or Satyagraha, on, coincidentally, September 11th. And this was pointed out by one of the speakers, I believe, from India, at an extremely important event that just happened this past November 19th, 2012, at which Richard Gage was a speaker, Michael Chosudovsky was a speaker, Cynthia McKinney was a speaker, and individuals from all around the world were speakers. It's on YouTube. It was a conference that was called Revisiting 9/11 that was orchestrated and hosted by the former Prime Minister of Malaysia. And in the audience were, they said, 30 ambassadors from 30 different countries around the world. And at that, I believe it was the Indian speaker who mentioned how important it was that Gandhi's Satyagraha movement started on September 11th, and that we need to turn the 9/11 truth movement into a worldwide truth movement to stop these secrets that they only get by with their evil because they have unnecessary secrecy. So how can our reality-based community, as George Bush and Karl Rove called us, as opposed to the lie-based community, how can we prevail over the power and the lie-based community? We need to unite the facts with the force, the satyagraha of the truth. And we do that as individual citizens. We have the power within ourselves to officialize the truth every single day, because credibility is a zero-sum game. We need to take the oath of telling the truth into our own hands. And you do that in a very simple way. You can take sworn jurate affidavits. You don't have to be a notary public to do so, but I recommend that every single one of us in the worldwide truth movement become, for a few dollars and a little bit of training, to become notary publics so that we can take sworn jurate affidavits. And most people don't know it, but in California, at least, where I live, a notary public, when a notary public notarizes a document, it becomes an official state of California document. So because credibility is a zero-sum game, if you have the lie, the people, the insiders who did the job and have covered it up with the lie, they have a lie and they have credibility. But as we increase our credibility by officializing the truth and getting witness testimonies, as I did with April Gallup, under oath, and then doing the transcript and getting a sworn jurate affidavit, making it into official state document, those can be used in court. And we need to do that with every single one of the witnesses that have already come forward. It's a simple thing to do. When I was researching my book, October Surprise, I was trying to, I nothing had changed. I had all the same evidence, like I'm showing you here, but I hadn't officialized it yet. And nobody would, they would pay attention, they would say, oh, that's very nice, yes, I agree with you, and nothing would happen in the real world. The rubber wasn't meeting the road in terms of politics or the law. And one day I had the idea, well, what the heck? You know, I have a friend who's a notary public, Betty Phillips in Pacific Grove, California. I'm gonna go take my statement of what I experienced in the Reagan campaign and about the October surprise, the truth behind the Iran side of Iran-Contra. I'm going to take that in and I'm going to type it up and I'm going to have her do a swear me up and do a sworn jurid affidavit. And when I did that, it was like people's mental doors opened up. The Democratic Party, officialdom, it went all the way to the top. And pretty soon there was a full subpoena power congressional investigation in the House of Representatives. So these, we need to officialize the truth, and we do that in a worldwide pro-truth movement, and we need to do that under the aegis and umbrella and the of Mahatma Gandhi's Satyagraha movement. Where are we now? I'm just going to very briefly review the major 9/11 truth events of the past year and how we lay the evidential groundwork to bring the real perpetrators to justice. Interestingly, even though the Pentagon attack has been kind of the black sheep of the 9/11 truth movement, which for reasons that are pretty clear to me, at the beginning of my talk, I told you why it's the most important part of the 9/11 attacks, and therefore the real perpetrators would not want the 9/11 truth movement to go there. And many people in the 9/11 truth movement even said, well, we shouldn't look at the Pentagon attack. There's too much controversy. Some people say it was a North Pass, South Pass, so we shouldn't go there. Well, even despite this, amazingly, because I focus on the Pentagon attack and have for over 11 years, I was the only invited expert witness to testify at both the Toronto 9/11 hearings and the Vancouver 9/11 hearings, which is a small miracle, really. The force is with us. It truly is. And then, of course, I mentioned the Malaysia conference. By the way, the Toronto hearings, this is very important. This is the 911 Toronto report. It just came out, I believe, last November. Every single American should own this document. This report is my paper on the Pentagon attack. It's chapter 13. And there are chapters in here by all of the expert witnesses at Toronto. And this cover was intentionally designed by James Gourley, who is the editor of the report and who sponsored the Toronto hearings, which were on the 10th anniversary in Toronto, Canada. He intentionally designed the cover so that at a distance it would look identical to the 9/11 Commission report. So if you just hold up the 9/11 Commission report, this 571-page lie, you can hold up the truth by the 9/11 truth movement. So please get this, read it. It is incredibly revealing, and it shows the depth of the evidence that we have already produced, which was the whole point of the Malaysia conference that was sponsored by the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, held on the, I think, the day the 9/11 Toronto report came out. So also you should know that one of the four judges, they were called a panel, the panelists, like a panel of judges, to whom we gave our testimony at Toronto on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, one of the four judges called panelists was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy. And he is, to this day, the honorary Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy and the President, as I recall, also a title of the Supreme Court of Italy. And so this is an extremely important and serious time when we have reached, the 9/11 truth movement has reached a critical mass of evidence, including some evidence now being taken under jurid affidavit sworn testimony, which did happen at Jim Fetzer's Vancouver hearings. All of the testimony was taken sworn under oath. At the Malaysia conference, and I should mention, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Italy, who is one of the panelist judges at the Toronto hearings, he has the final chapter in this 911 Toronto report, and he has gone public stating, including here, that it is his intent to take it to the Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. And it doesn't really matter that to this point the United States is not a signatory to the jurisdiction of the court because some 80 innocent victims of some 80 countries, most of whom are signatories of the International Criminal Court and therefore have jurisdiction, can bring this matter before the International Criminal Court, and that includes Italy, his country. The greatest accountability opportunity of all, in my opinion, is the upcoming 9/11 Guantanamo trial. Believe it or not, as I was on the airplane coming here, which was on January 10th, so I was reading the New York Times of January 10th about what happened the day before, January 9th, just a few days ago, the chief prosecutor of the Guantanamo Military Tribunal announced Wednesday, January 9th, that he is abandoning terrorism conspiracy charges against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other 9/11 5. Now, why is that important? Why is that incredibly important? Why does it matter so greatly for our truth movement? The 9/11 truth movement, as I and others have shown, has proven that although Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other 9/11 5 may have conspired and plotted something like the 9/11 attacks, it is physically impossible that they were the actual perpetrators or executors of those attacks. And therefore, the chief prosecutor of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the 9/11 5 has just ruled out the only charge that they could possibly be found guilty of under the facts, leaving only what they could never be found guilty of, which is the actual act. This is extremely important, and the 9/11 truth movement, I believe, needs to get this report as well as sworn affidavits as soon as possible to the defense attorneys of the 9/11 5. And in conclusion, the 9/11 truth movement and we the citizens, we the people, must never give up. If we don't, because this is a zero-sum game, we will eventually win, and the real perpetrators will be brought to justice. Thank you.